Hi, welcome to the Top 100 Project with Ryan and Bev Ellis. If you're a new listener, we invite you to check out our introductory podcast, our prequel episode, if you will, where we talk about our project analyzing the American Film Institute and their 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American films ever made. Warning, there are spoilers ahead. This podcast is meant to be listened to after you've seen the film.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Okay, Bev and Ryan and Fox in our Sweatbox recording studio are here with the Top 100 Project's 19th movie, and it's our first taste of John Wayne and John Ford with their Western Stagecoach. It was a comfy 63rd between Tootsie and Close Encounters of the Third Kind on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list, but was kicked off the team and didn't make the 2007 list at all. After a premiere on February 15, 1939, Stagecoach was released by United Artists on March 2nd. 1939, incidentally, Bev, is the most prolific AFI year with 5 films. That's going to cover an entire month plus for us of podcast. This was a very solid hit with audiences. Stagecoach's healthy box office receipts nearly doubled its budget. And if I may, movie in a nutshell, this one. Commuters face imminent death from rampaging forces during an uncomfortable trip through dusty landscape. And now Bev's got the skinny.
An eclectic group of people travel by horse and buggy through Monument Valley in 1880, even though Apache warriors, including superstar Geronimo, are on the warpath. After the cavalry detachment pulls away its escort, the coach is ripe for Indian attack.
And Bev, Indian attack is indeed what happens towards the end of this film. What did you think of a stagecoach?
Well, I'm going to start by pointing out some rather embarrassing facts, which is that, you know, I'm a lady and
yes, you are.
Yes. I have watched very few Westerns. Other than like the really obvious ones, like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Once Upon a Time in the West, and Unforgiven. I think prior to seeing this, I don't know if I'd ever seen another Western. And I don't know if I'd ever seen another Western that was like a really traditional, old-fashioned Western. And after seeing this, I can't even say that I necessarily have, because it doesn't really follow all the Western tropes,
still
right?
Not a cowboys and Indians kind of
thing. Yeah, tale. Yeah, exactly.
The Indians are there, although not really that. They're more of a MacGuffin. They're in the movie. They're part of the movie, but they're barely ever in.
Yeah, it's really not the real crux of the movie. Doesn't rest on that conflict.
Did they get, incidentally, did any of the Apaches get a close-up? Did you notice?
Yeah, definitely they did.
Okay, because I don't think they had a whole lot of dialogue or a whole lot of...
Well, definitely the
bona fide screen time in that sense.
There's the friendly Indian in the beginning who hates Apaches as much as everybody else does. He definitely gets a close-up.
I mean, the bad guys.
I feel like... Yeah, they definitely do. There's like a close pan when they're waiting to attack. I'm sure I saw close-ups of their faces.
Okay, but they are on like almost like the alien in the movie Alien.
Yeah, they don't speak.
Yeah,
they just attack. Like they really are. Of course, Hollywood has been accused many, many times over of being racist towards Native Americans, and definitely this is an example. Even though it's a very like socially liberal film, in many ways, it's actually its main theme is kind of railing against prejudice in all of its forms, and yet they show like extreme insensitive prejudice towards the Indian people.
That was a common thing for John Ford's Westerns, and he it's said that he tried to make an amends for that in some of the later ones, but in these early days, yeah, it was that sort of the booga booga bad guy out there.
So this is one of the very few Westerns I've ever seen. I don't really have a lot of context, and I know that it played on a lot of Western themes that I probably just wouldn't be familiar with. I also, this is the very first John Ford movie I've ever seen.
Whoa.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed. This is embarrassing. This is part of the reason why we decided to do this project, because I need an education. This is ridiculous.
Let me throw this out there before you make your next point. If directors of today were polled as to who they think the greatest director of all time is, Hitchcock would certainly be on that short list, and probably Billy Wilder would, and Spielberg and Scorsese would have a chance to make it, but I think they probably would vote for John Ford, and here you're saying, as a big movie person, you've never even seen until yesterday.
I'm not proud of this.
For your very first John Ford film.
Also, the very first John Wayne movie I've ever seen. I mean, I'm very familiar with his persona, but I had never seen him in a movie,
one of the biggest movie stars of all time.
I don't know if I'd ever, like, other than clips here and there, I barely had ever seen him on screen. Certainly, I've spent more time watching people do impressions of John Wayne than I've ever personally seen John Wayne.
What did you think of John Wayne, then?
I'm going to say I get it. I get why he was so popular. I get why he starred in so many movies. I get why people love John Ford. I loved this movie. like, loved this movie. I can't wait to watch more John Ford movies now.
We've got two more that we'll see on the list. Mm-hmm. One pretty soon, The Grapes of Wrath, 1940. And the other one is going to be The Searchers in 1956, mm-hmm. so that's quite a ways away. But yeah. Just those two for him. He also directed, let me find my notes.
How Green Was My Valley, which is the movie that notoriously beat Citizen Kane for the Best Picture Oscar.
And he also did My Darling Clementine with Henry Fonda, The Quiet Man with John Wayne again, mm-hmm. and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance with John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart, all of which would have been reasonable choices to make the top 100. Mm-hmm. And even How Green Is My Valley, not a favorite of mine, but it did win the Best Picture mm-hmm. Oscar, so anytime it does that, it's got a shot at making an AFI list.
Oh, I'll tell you, I kind of have a crush on this movie. I loved it so much. It really made an impression on me. I thought about it all day today. Well, kept remembering scenes from it.
I don't think we'd ever mentioned John Ford's name in a previous podcast. If we had, I can't think of a time, except for the last podcast, Bringing Up Baby, where we mentioned that it's been said that the relationship in the movie between Susan and David is based on a real relationship between John Ford and Katharine Hepburn. Mm-hmm. And now here we have a Ford movie. Another link from the previous movie, Dudley Nichols wrote Bringing Up Baby, and he also wrote this movie with Ben Hecht. Two of the great writers of that era, Ben Hecht, we're going to see more of him as we go along. They adapted Ernest Haycox's short story called The Stage to Lordsburg. And I think they did a good job of giving each character their own personality, even though they're all playing stereotypes.
I get that they're stereotypes, but I really felt like each character had so much depth to them. Like, you could tell they had a backstory above and beyond just kind of what was written on the page. Some of the performances were a little bit corny, but it didn't matter because they were interesting. Each of the characters experienced growth of some kind. That I think that's a big part of what I loved about it. It was just so complex, yet it was really clean. Like, it didn't feel like there was anything there that didn't need to be there. It was very lean in the way it was written and directed.
Yes, it was. It was a short movie.
Yeah, even though there's so many characters. But mm-hmm. you still really felt like you knew each and every one of them.
There are so many characters, I thought you could call it the Gilligan's Island of Westerns. You've got the banker, the doctor, the cop, the salesman, the driver, the whore, the gambler, the mother, and the criminal, who, mm-hmm. of course, is the Ringo Kid, who is John Wayne.
But it plays against those stereotypes, too, because if you think about it, say, like, the mother, that's a great example. When you think about the mother, you think about who she would, you know, on Gilligan's Island, she would be Marianne. But she's not sweet. She's kind of a jerk.
Yeah.
And she's not even a particularly caring mother. Like, when the shootout is happening, it's Dallas, the prostitute, who's protecting the baby right. from the gunfire with her body.
And John Carradine, who's the gambler, seems like he's going to be a villain, ends up being noble and mm-hmm. does a noble thing.
Although he's complicated too, you know? He's a Confederate soldier yeah. and proud Confederate South. Soldier, yeah.
And we're not that far from the Civil War with
and
this
he's
movie.
And he certainly is a first-class jerk to Dallas, who doesn't treat him with any
respect
whatsoever.
But has honor towards...
Yeah, very much so. In yeah. fact, the only reason he gets on the stagecoach to begin with is to look after her, because he doesn't trust that she'll be okay on that stagecoach by mm-hmm. herself. There's no other reason given for him to come along, except to just, like, do right by Mrs. Mallory for no other reason than because she needs help.
Well, that was John Carradine who played that character. You've maybe never seen a movie that he's been in before. No. And he's one of the great character actors, and he was also a Ford regular. He's in The Grapes of Wrath, mm-hmm. and he later on played Dracula quite a few times.
He's also
part of, and he's part of the Carradine family of Keith and later Robert, and
David,
of course, yes, yeah. Kung Fu himself, yes. Bill of Kill Bill.
Yes.
There's also a small role for Tim Holt, who's in one of my favorite 1940s films, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, mm-hmm. which you've not seen either, and no? I can't wait for you to see that one. I guess the biggest name of the supporting cast has got to be Thomas Mitchell, and this is the first of five AFI movies that Mitchell was in. There's two more in 1939 alone. He's got Gone with the Wind and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Mitchell played the boozy doctor.
Oh, yeah. He was really funny.
It was a strong performance, which he won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor.
Oh, wow.
I think this
really
is our first supporting performance to win an Oscar, because it happened one night, one for leading actor mm-hmm. and actress, but this is the first supporting performance we've had. A note I definitely had to take down, and I'd forgotten, because I'd not seen this movie in, I guess it's been 15 years, but a note I had taken down about the banker. I love that he says when we first see him, what's good for the banks is good for the country. And that's not long before stealing 50,000 from his own bank.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, the economic times when this movie came out are more or less mirrored by the economic times of, like, 2010. So mm-hmm. think about how people feel about bankers now. That's exactly how they felt about bankers then. He's not very subtle dig on the banking industry in general. Just and even like, I think there's a line when he's in the stagecoach where he's huffing and puffing about how an American president should be a businessman. And, you know, you and I, of course, were like, doesn't that sound familiar? That's exactly what Mitt Romney ran on. Meanwhile, you know, people like him, bankers like him, who they're stealing from people.
Yeah, and at least he gets his comeuppance at the end of this film.
Yeah, which is, you know, of course, part of the whole overarching subtext of the movie, which is that it really did kind of reflect those economic times and the Great Depression. So it's not just that the banker is this pompous lying thief who gets his comeuppance to, you know, I'm sure the audience's delight as they watch that, but all the heroes are the lower class. The Ringo Kid and Dallas, they are like the pariahs of society. And it's kind of shown that it's not really necessarily by their own fault that they end up in the circumstances that they were. And they end up being the most noble people, like kind of the heroes.
Which is one reason why the marshal lets them get away at the end.
Yeah.
What a wink wink sort of, yeah, yeah, okay.
Because that's really justice, you know, like really justice in the end is that the banker gets arrested, is that the plumber boys get killed, and that Ringo and Dallas get away to go just like start their fresh new life together, which they, yeah, it's the happy ending
and
for the poor.
And she will be a whore no more.
Yep.
Even though she's our first hooker with a heart of gold. I think there'll be some more of those to come, either literally or figuratively. Women who are of supposedly low moral character who do things like this, but change their ways when they find the love of a good man. It's definitely a trope in movies. It may not be as big in the AFI 123. So that's Clara Trevor playing. They don't really call her a hooker in the movie, but we know that's what she's supposed to be. And she actually had top billing and was paid the most money in this film because Wayne was a nobody.
Star.
We'll get to John Wayne's history soon. But Trevor was the big star going into the movie.
Yeah, she made the most.
And Mitchell was the most respected actor.
I really loved her character and kind of what happened. You just root for her so much. You know, despite, you know, being treated so poorly by the other passengers, you know, with the exception of Ringo, she's the more noble of the two women. I definitely got the impression that when Mrs. Mallory went into labor, it seems to me that Dallas is the one that knew what to do, you know? She was in a whorehouse. You would presume she probably would know what to do in the event a woman goes into labor. She's the one who's telling them to deliver hot water. She's the one that stays up all night with the baby and is taking care of the baby. And yet still in the morning, you know, after everything is said and done, the doctor is celebrated and then, you know, they just turn to her and go, hey, go make coffee for the men, will ya?
Well, there's all kinds of movie sexism in this movie where horses are more valuable than wives
and other women
in general.
Yeah. At least they're not like your typical damsels in distress. And that's kind of nice. I would take this, like their maltreatment but fully realized characters, over, say, like the Tahitian women in Mutiny on the Bounty.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this definitely, to me, is a far less sexist movie because at least, you know, you are meant to empathize with Dallas and even Mrs. Mallory for all of her faults. They're fully realized characters and you care about them and you, you know, kind of feel the sting when, after everything Dallas does, she just gets sent to go make coffee for everybody. I like that. I like that much better. So I say, like, she's not necessarily just the hooker with a heart of gold. She's, like, a noble prostitute. She has this real nobility about her. And then in the end, she gets her reward. She gets her happy ending.
Well, the whole stagecoach, essentially, is the people that no one wants. And let's bring it back to the big star of the movie, John Wayne himself. He was the actor that no one wanted except for John Ford.
Yeah, his story's really interesting.
And Ford had to fight to get John Wayne in this role. David Selznick, the infamous David Selznick, who produced Gone with the Wind, bailed on producing the project once Ford refused to cast Gary Cooper, who was a big star by that point. And it's Wayne's breakthrough performance after dozens of movies. Wayne has said he made 80 movies. I didn't count that many on the IMDb, but he still made many films. And in several of them, he even appears unbilled, which proves that he was no golden boy to begin with, unlike other big stars. Also, Wayne was paid peanuts as a result. As I said, Trevor was the biggest star and was paid the most money. But Wayne was paid, I think, the least of all of them.
It was like less than $10,000.
And even at that, Ford berated him to get a better performance. It's been said that John Ford would make John Wayne cry by mocking him. I don't know what exactly he said, but Marion Morrison, John Wayne, and that is his real name if you didn't know that.
I knew that. Marion Morrison.
But he would make him cry. I don't know if he made him cry in this film, but I've heard that. And Wayne revered him when he would talk about him, unless it was just being political. And
well, he made his career. There's no doubt about that. They were friends before they even made the picture together.
Maybe there's a part of him that realized that whatever it takes to get a better performance out of me is what it takes.
Well, apparently Ford was a real dictator on set. And part of the reason that he would always shoot in Monument Valley. This is the first movie he shot in Monument Valley, but I think he went on to make Many six or more. Seven more?
Oh, yeah, at least that many.
And apparently part of the reason he shot there was because it was so remote.
Yeah, no producers could interfere. Yeah,
it was very inconvenient for Hollywood executives to come and kind of micromanage him and have any say at all in what he was doing. And that was part of the reason why he liked to shoot there so much.
It also gave those great monuments.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's beautiful. It's also beautiful.
And that's one of the things about influence with this film, that so many movies have shot out there for the same reason.
If you were to, like, ask a child to describe what a Western looks like, they would describe, you know, the setting as Monument Valley. Like, when I picture in my head, even though I've seen very few Westerns, as I admitted, I always imagine Monument Valley is the setting for all Westerns, and this is the first Western that was ever set there. So there you go for influence.
John Wayne maybe didn't influence a ton of other actors the way that, say, Brando did with the Actors Studio crowd. But he certainly, as I said, was a gigantic star in the business. And I've said before to other people, when people talk about who's the biggest basketball star of all time, the biggest baseball star of all time, the biggest boxer, you're going to get different opinions about who the most talented is. But who is the person that somebody who doesn't know anything about those sports would think of? If you said basketball, it's Michael Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
If you said hockey, it's Wayne Gretzky. If you said baseball, it's Babe Ruth. And please, listeners, I'm not saying that they're all the best. I'm saying they're the icons of their sport. Who is it for movies? You said to me,
Marilyn Monroe.
And I don't agree that she is the icon for movies. She's certainly one of the ones you'd have to think of. I said years ago to somebody, it's John Wayne. I don't know if I still feel that way anymore. Opinions change, attitudes change, but it's hard to pick that one person who is the movie star of all movie stars. But whether he is that or not, he only had two AFI Top 100 films, Stagecoach and The Searchers, and it was only one in 2007 because they voted out Stagecoach.
Yeah, I can't believe that this fell off the list.
63rd
I cannot believe it.
Not being on at all.
I am absolutely outraged that this got voted off the list, and I'm curious to see these other Westerns that did make the list.
There were plenty of other ones.
They better be great.
You haven't seen them yet, obviously, but Shane and The Searchers and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and The Wild Bunch and Dances with Wolves and Unforgiven, and there may be others, but that's a big list right there.
I don't think I could count.
One more, and that's High Noon. It's the next Western we're going to have, and it's not till 1952. A much different kind of Western than this was, and John Wayne was not a fan of it. That'll be a very political movie, and as we've said, we'll get very political in some of our films, including we were maybe 5 minutes ago, but that's a very political film. It's also many months away for us. We've talked a bunch about John Wayne. Now let's talk more, as we already have, I guess, but let's talk some more about John Ford. This is the first example, as we've said, of a Ford-Wayne racist portrayal of Native Americans in a film. There will be many others that you can watch. There are not many other AFI films because, as we've said, they only did two together that made the list. Although The Searchers is pretty racist, too. But they did many Westerns together, and Ford did many Westerns even without Wayne. This was his first sound Western, though, after many silents that he had done, and he had to fight to get it made because sound was tough to shoot on location.
Also, Westerns had fallen out of favor. They weren't very popular at the time. They weren't making any money. They were only really shot as B-films.
That's a streaky genre, because when Dances with Wolves won the Oscar in 1990 and was a huge hit, Coster found it hard to get that made because it had been out of style again.
And Unforgiven wasn't that far behind it
a couple
either.
Years later.
But then after that, can you think of like another popular Western? Not counting really like something like Brokeback that isn't really a traditional Western.
Well, Open Range, but is it popular? I mean, it double-ditch budgets, but it was not an award winner of any kind, and nobody really thinks of it.
I don't even actually know what that movie
Kevin Costner and Robert Duvall.
Open Range? Yeah. Oh, and I guess there was like Tombstone and...
Tombstone, yeah.
Yeah.
Year after Unforgiven, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a little streak. It had like a little,
it's a very
little
streaky
bubble
genre.
and then that was that.
There had been a Western that had won the Best Picture Oscar before Stagecoach, and it was Cimarron, which I've seen once and don't remember anything about it now, but that was 1931. And the next time an Oscar went to a Western film, even though there were tons of them made in the 50s especially, the next one that won an Oscar was Dances with Wolves, nearly 60 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But Ford loved them. He shot them constantly. He would say when he was introduced to somebody, "Hi, I'm John Ford. I shoot Westerns."
Like, after he made this movie, that was it. He was like, okay, I found my voice.
And he wasn't a technical director that Spielberg would be considered to be, or even Hitchcock. And yet, with what he had at the time and the way he made movies, and the kind of the very matter-of-fact way he made movies, very realistic. He was not a fantasy director of any kind. I did love his technical style. I love the way he shot this film.
Me too.
Burt Glennon was a cinematographer. He did a great job. It's another black and white movie, incidentally. We said Snow White was the first color film. We're back into black and white for a little while again. Bringing Up Baby last week was a black and white film. This one, the next week's one, Wuthering Heights, also black and white. And Hawks, Ford, and next week, William Wyler's, three of the greats of that time, are all proving that if you can make black and white films look probably even better than color films. Ford even had great camera angles, especially during the action scenes. Like that one great shot of the camera on the stagecoach when they crossed the water.
I loved that shot. Mm. I was crazy about it.
Couldn't
have
been easy to do back then with those giant cameras.
And he did something like, this is the first movie I think we've seen in a while where you have a director that's actually being really creative and expressive with where he puts the camera. Mm-hmm. You know, the way something like Sunrise did. And as much as I loved Bringing Up Baby or the Chaplin movies, certainly are, you know, they're the great, but the camera is just there. It's just capturing what's going on. And I, you know, I often speak about how much I hate when they overdo it. But when you have a genius like this making a real piece of art with the camera, it was just lovely. That's really what I loved about it.
There's a shot in How Green Is My Valley when a woman gets married to the wrong man. And the man who she really loves and who loves her back is in the distance when they're all coming out of the church. And he's in silhouette. And someone asked why they didn't get a shot of the fellow, a close-up of him. And Ford said, they'd just use it. Meaning the studio who would actually edit the films. Directors didn't really edit their films the way that they do now. So
they'd just use it.
But there you go.
That was Hitchcock's strategy as well. He would only shoot exactly what he wanted and never any cutaways for safety. Because he didn't want anybody to cut it anyway except how he imagined it.
And Peter Bogdanovich, he was a disciple of both of those guys, Ford and and Hitchcock. Also, at least with Last Picture Show, a little story about that. The studio had troubles with, oh my God, the footage we're getting. He's not getting any coverage. The director, Bob Rafelson, who was part of the studio that was helping to make Last Picture Show, was called in. And he watched the footage and said, he's shooting the movie in his head. He doesn't need a lot of coverage. Yeah. Leave me alone. Don't bother me again. And don't bother him again.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Bogdanovich definitely learned a lot from Ford and from
But they're all, Hitchcock. You know, very controlling directors.
Ford also did a great thing with the low ceilings when they're indoors. They're indoors a couple different times. They obviously have to sleep. And he has the really low ceilings, and that contrasts with the wide open spaces out on the trail. Mm-hmm. And when we get into the influence in a few minutes here, Orson Welles must have learned that from watching this movie many times, and he did it with Citizen Kane. Of course, the ceilings are constantly a factor in Citizen Kane.
Yeah, Orson Welles must have not actually taken it that hard when he lost the Oscar to John Ford, because he, according to his biographer, watched this movie 40 times or more before he made Citizen Kane. Mm-hmm. He considered it like his education. He studied it.
It was the way to make movies. Mm-hmm. I read the same thing. Yeah, it's a pretty famous story.
Mm-hmm.
One more line I gotta say about John Ford is that when someone asked why the Indians didn't just shoot the horses in the big chase scene, obviously that would stop the whole chase, and Ford had the Hitchcock answer, because then the movie would be over.
You love that.
Hitchcock gave that answer about many things. Why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? Because there'd be no movie. I would say it helped strengthen the stereotypical savage Indian, the savage Apache, who's only out to kill and maim the white man.
Yeah, their motives aren't really... There's no motive given for why they're attaching just a stagecoach. Because. They're clearly not soldiers. They're just, you know, innocent people trying to get from one place to another. It is actually pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. The movie was remade a few times, including in 1966 with Anne Margaret and Red Buttons. And it was also a TV movie in 1986 with, get this cast.
Oh, dear.
Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, his wife June, and even Beauduc himself, John Schneider.
Were they serious? Were they being ironic?
I've never seen it. I'd never heard of it until I looked it up.
Oh, that's embarrassing.
Willie Nelson plays Doc Holliday, which is the biggest difference between this version of Stagecoach and that version of Stagecoach.
That's There's a pretty Doc big Holliday difference.
Yeah. The other names, looked like they were mostly the same. Yeah.
Wow. Let's never watch that.
I think I have to try to find that movie.
Okay, maybe let's watch it, but let's have a few drinks.
Of those guys, Kristofferson is by far the best actor.
Really? You don't care for the career of Willie Nelson?
He was funny in Why the Dog. All right, and the awards, other AFI lists for Stagecoach. It was the 9th best Western in the top 100 genres category. We talked about most of the other ones that made that top 10 already on this podcast, Unforgiven and Butch Cassidy and so many others. The movie won an Oscar for Thomas Mitchell as Best Supporting Actor, as we said. It also won an Oscar for Best Music Score.
Yeah, so pretty famous. Like, you recognize it when it comes out. There's parts of it where I would consider it overused, but the themes are really great.
Yeah. And it was another film that's in the National Film Registry in Congress in 1995. They added it to that.
It was a later edition, but it made it.
I have one more thing I'd like to say, which is that you raved about the movie when we got started on this. I don't like it as much as you did. I don't dislike it. I'm a Western fan. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to seeing some of the other ones. But I don't think this one's one of the absolute best films. I don't know if it should have been knocked right off the list when it was 63rd the first time. That happens so often in this 98 to 2007, where a movie was 44th or 72nd or something, or 63rd in this case.
Over the
It'd be one thing if it was 95th and got knocked off.
Yeah.
But more often than not, the films that were in the 90s and 80s moved up rather than get knocked off.
Well, who knows? Maybe I am a Western fan. I just didn't know because I haven't really seen very many Westerns. Maybe I love Westerns.
I don't think that most of the Westerns in the top 100 are true cowboys and Indians type movies, which is like stereotype and cliche. Yeah. So maybe you'll like them more than you think.
Yeah.
I think you'll find Butch Cassidy funny. I hope you do. It's one of my favorite comedies. The Wild Bunch is not really a Western either. It's the Indians, quote unquote, are the Mexicans.
I've actually seen The Wild Bunch before. I never think of that as a Western, actually.
Dance with Wolves is debatably a Western. Although
I love Dances with Wolves as well.
So you're a Western fan, a closet Western
maybe
fan.
Maybe I am a Western
fan. And then when we get some of the musicals that I like, I'll be the closet musical fan.
I'll catch you like singing the songs to yourself as you're doing dishes or something.
Okay, so that was Stagecoach. Up next on the Top 100 Project is our first look at Laurence Olivier in William Wyler's Wuthering Heights.
That's a mouthful. In the meantime, for more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. And you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com, and follow us on Twitter, @top100project. And